This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Hi, everybody. I'm John Loeffler. Welcome to a special edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. For this holiday weekend, we're featuring highlights from Jim Poplava's Investment Strategy Conference, which took place on October 21st of this year. The charts and visuals referred to on this program can be found with the program description on the website at financialsense.com.
We're going to go ahead and get started. I'm starting a little early, so I have a little time to kill, so I'm going to tell a couple stories. But anyway, I want to give you a little insight about what we do with our podcast and Financial Sense. If many of you are local, I had the opportunity back in 1990 and 91 to do television news. I was stupid enough to work a day job and then go down to the television studio and work 4.5 hours. Imagine working 9 a.m. to 11 p.m. But in that, I got a lot of insight in terms of how we shape the news. And one of the things that really surprised me was the amount of news that was out there, because I had access to just about everything to do stories. And I would print these stories out and I saw them nowhere in the newspapers. So a lot of the news that you get is shaped by a lot of the news that you don't get, what you don't see. And I'd bring home these stories and I'd go, I can't believe I don't see this anywhere. But we had a saying in the news business, if it bleeds, it leads. And so that's why if you turn on the news, you see, you know, car accidents, people getting shot. And I can remember one Friday going into the news studio, it was 5 o'clock. We were in panic mode. Number one, there were no shootings. There were no car accidents. We couldn't report. And we have at the television studio, we have police scanners, because that's how if there's a shooting or something, we can send our reporters and news crew. And here it was the first hour. We had nothing. I mean, what were you going to do with an hour newscast and talk about nothing? Finally, we got lucky. A jogger got bit by a dog in Oceanside. And that was our leading story. Tonight at 10, dog bites jogger. Details. We actually sent a camera crew. We interviewed the dog owner. We couldn't interview the dog. The dog couldn't talk, but barked. And another story I wanted to tell you, it was kind of funny. I am very fortunate to have a good crew and sons that have gone in the business that allowed me to do what I love to do. I have a large library and I get to spend each day doing what I love, which is reading, which I credit to my mother back in second grade, taking me to the library during the summers, and I would read all these books on history. So this was about 2 weeks ago, and there's some kind of series on television about Mehmet and the loves of his life. It's a Czech version of the Byzantine Empire. So Mary's in there watching this story about Mehmet and the loves in his life. I'm in my study watching the ammo dump version of it on the History Channel, where they recreated Mehmet's cannon, 16-foot walls, and showed what this cannon could do to these walls. Then I'm also later on Amazon, and that's when I had this epiphany of Alexa and the brand maker and what it was doing. Drove Mary crazy, because at 11 o'clock at night, I'm excited about this to tell her, and she goes, can't we just go to bed? So anyway, we're going to go ahead and get started. What we're going to cover in this hour is, you'll notice a theme that we've been developing since the first hour. What have we been talking about? We've been talking about risk, how to assess it. It's also one of the biggest things that you face in retirement, because one of the things you do not want to do is go through, can you imagine if you started your retirement in the year 2000, or for that matter in 2008? Can imagine what you went through in the following couple of years. So we're going to talk about managing risk and understand the risk to your retirement. So we'll talk about these risks, the proposed tax law changes, and risk itself. If you look at retirement planning today, there's basically two stages. The accumulation phase, when you were actually building up, putting money aside, and building up for your retirement. And I can't tell you how important that is going to become in the next decade. because more and more of you are going to have to rely on your own personal savings to help get you through retirement, because we are going to be going through Social Security reform in the next decade. I guarantee you that because of what has happened. So you go through the accumulation phase, you hit the peak, it's retirement, and then it's the downside of the mountain. It's distribution. You're relying on your assets. The average couple today, age 65, will spend 25 years in retirement. That's the average. And there are people that are living longer. Children born today have a 50% chance of living to age 100. There are more and more centenarians around. We have a lot of clients at a retirement home. Many, they tell me, are in their hundreds. We have clients in our 90s. Just met one of you who's 89. Any 90-year-olds here? Okay, you're pretty close. How many months away?
Seven
months away. Okay. So we're living longer. And what does that mean? We're going to have to rely on these assets over a longer period of time. So it's important to avoid risk and also the ravages of inflation. So you've probably seen this if you've ever been to Vegas or if you ever watched a movie. Have you ever seen that gambler? He's at the roulette table or he's at the blackjack table. The chips start piling up and you're thinking, oh, dude, walk away from the table. Take some of that off. What does he do? Pushes it all forward. One more last bet. One of the worst things that we have to deal with in the investment business is human emotion. Not just yours, but our very own. Especially when you buy a stock that's doing well, you get very excited and you think nothing worse can happen to it. So you have to deal with these and you have to have that ability to walk away from the table, which is one reason why over the last decade, we've gone more and more to modeling, whether it's on the economy or on the markets. And we do that for a specific reason. We want to take the human emotion out of investing. We don't want to fall in love with the markets. We don't want to fall in love with companies. I mean, the company that I started working for, I was programming IBM mainframe computers. Think of IBM as the giant of technology in its day. Look where it is today. Look at Kodak. By the way, Kodak invented digital photography. But they thought photography was just about paper, selling the photos, not about photography itself. So you want to be able to walk away from the table. And what you don't want to do is start out your retirement with something that we refer to as something called sequence risk. That is going through a major bear market at the beginning of your retirement. As Chris and I have shown you the graphs of how long it takes to recover. And one of the things that we do not do at our firm is we do not rely on these standard models, standard returns, even in our financial planning software. Because if you rely on them, they'll tell you if you invest in stocks, your average return will be 10% a year. That did not work from 2000 to 2014, where on a price basis, the S&P went nowhere. It wasn't until April 2014 that we finally passed the records set earlier. So what you want to avoid at the beginning of your retirement is going through a major drawdown of a bear market. And we've met some people in 2008 when you thought everything was going to be great, or the year 2000. Look what happened. You realize from October of 2007 to March of 2009, the S&P lost 58% of its value. So you want to avoid this at all costs, because right now, and I love magazine covers as contra indicators, that's the economists, the bull market and everything. Can you think of anything right now that is really going down? Stocks are going up. Bonds are going up. Commodities are starting to go up. Real estate is going up. So it looks like the good times are here. But this is a picture of returns from 1979 to 2009. Let's take a person's lifespan saving for retirement. The returns were 9.3. But here's the problem you run into is what we call the drawdown, where you're taking an average distribution rate of about 4 or 5%. Just don't live too long because you run into trouble. We're seeing more and more of this today where we're seeing families move into families. We have a client whose mother recently was diagnosed, she had a stroke, diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. She was living comfortably until the stroke, until the Alzheimer's. Now she's in a long-term care facility, and thank goodness it's Arizona because the costs are running about $6,500 a month. That was something that wasn't planned for. And these are the things that you have to deal with in retirement because we're living longer today. 25 years between a husband and wife will be spent in retirement. That's the average. You have a 50% chance at age 65 of reaching the age 90 and beyond. So as we live longer, we have to depend on more and more of those assets to help get us through retirement. Now, if you look at inflation-adjusted returns, you've seen this graph a couple times. From 1968 to 1992, it took 24 years to break even. Look at these downfalls. This is what you want to avoid. Here we are from the year 2000 on inflation-adjusted terms. It took to February 2015. Look at that drawdown from 2000 to 2002, and then once again going back to the mid-decade. This is what you want to evolve, and this is why we believe, with markets being what they are, with central banks and governments interfering in the economy, we are going to have more turbulence in the markets. Just take a look at the last 10, 15 years, which is why we are big proponents of active management. There's healthcare cost. Average around $9,000 a year. Every single year, Fidelity releases a study on the average out-of-pocket cost for a couple age 65 beginning your retirement. Anybody have any idea what that number is today, 2017? Anybody want to guess?
$250,000.
A little higher, pretty close. Close to $270,000. And that is out-of-pocket cost. That includes your Medicare premiums, your Medigap insurance, and out-of-pocket expenses. As many of you know that are on Medicare, I finally got there. I can't believe it. But what do they do? How many of the things they don't cover, especially new drugs, new treatments, special tests? There are a lot of things, and this doesn't include long-term care insurance. We have one of the most expensive healthcare systems in the world, but we have some of the best. Some of the best technology was developed here. The other things that you're going to face are taxes and lower returns. And this is once again why you want to practice and why we practice risk management. You do not want to go through another drawdown. How many of you, if you're 5-10 years away from retirement, you should be practicing risk control at this point in your life? Because you don't know when this bull market's going to end. We have an idea where we think the high probability where it might end. Markets will end before the economy ends. The stock market peaked in October of 2007. In December of 2007, we were in a recession. So usually the market will telegraph in advance what is going to happen in the economy. And you will not know it's coming, as I will show you in a moment, because the market is dominated by a handful of stocks that make up the indexes. So how do you manage risk? You do that through planning. Let me tell you about healthcare. Right now, Obamacare is collapsing. Premiums are going up. Premiums average 25%. If you are on Social Security, you know there is now four-tiered pricing on Social Security depending on where your income is. And there's something called the Hold Harmless Clause. And that means they cannot raise your Medicare premiums more than what they raise your Social Security increase. That is so you make less money. But that only applies for 70% of you. As a result of George W. Bush, when they added Medicare Part D, they came up with a tiered pricing system on Medicare, and depending on your income, you can pay four times the amount on the premiums. So we know they have to fix it. There's something they have to do, whether they repeal it, they replace it, modify it. Change is coming to the healthcare system. It is unsustainable in its present path as more and more insurers exit the marketplace. A good example is my former state I grew up in, Arizona, Obamacare premiums are up 116% this year. And the reason I know that, I have a sister who is on one of the programs. Another thing that took place, and you may have not heard about it unless you listened to our show, was Social Security. The Social Security Disability Fund was running out of money in 2016. So what did Congress do? They passed a budget bill in 2015 that ended favorable ways of taking your Social Security that benefited women. Nobody said anything about it, because 85% of the survivors on Social Security are women. You live longer than us guys. And there used to be something called file and suspend. And the way it worked was, let's say the husband was age 66. The husband would file for Social Security and then file suspension. He wouldn't get it. And as long as he wasn't taking it, it would grow by 8% a year until age 70, a 32% increase in Social Security payments. Now, when the husband did that and file and suspend, it enabled his wife to take 50% of his Social Security so she could begin taking that. She could allow her Social Security to grow at 8% a year. And then at age 70, she can make the decision to either take her own Social Security or half of her husband's. But what it did is it left the surviving spouse, usually the woman, better off, because when one spouse passes away, you only get one check. One goes away. Surviving spouse has the privilege of either taking her husband's Social Security or her own. Well, that went away with file and suspend. So a lot of changes have come to healthcare and Social Security, and you will see major changes to Social Security coming in the next decade. We're also dealing with the tax bill, which I will get to shortly. But one of the ways you avoid risk, I don't care if it's from financial planning, there are a number of reasons you might want to redo your estate plan, family changes, grandchildren, marriages, health, wealth, changes in the economy. And I can guarantee you one thing, as long as we have politicians, you will have changing tax laws. One of the reasons we emphasize active management, if you take a buy and hold strategy or just a diversified portfolio of 50-50, you can see there the difference in periods, because your drawdowns are less. Nobody wants to go through a 58% drawdown or a 70% drawdown as we saw in NASDAQ stocks at the beginning of the last decade. So we believe in active management, active planning, because how many of you have seen your financial situation change, family change, the birth of grandchildren, the increase of wealth, health changes? There are a number of reasons why you want to plan and be active. We have this idea in our industry that it sells it. It's this set and forget. You go in, you buy a bunch of funds, they put together your portfolio, and you don't worry about it. You just put it aside and you live your life. What happens? Markets change, the economy changes, Fed policy changes, government policy changes, and your personal circumstances change. We have a very sophisticated program that it measures risk, but it does two things. On a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the most aggressive, 1 being the most conservative, most individuals we find as they near retirement have a risk score between 3 and 4. One of the things that this program does, and one of the things that we find, they may have a risk score of 3 and 4, and when we look at their portfolio, they have a risk score of 6 and 7. There's a dichotomy between your ability to accept risk. You get nervous when the market's down 10% or a stock you bought is down 10%, versus the willingness to accept risk. And what you want to really do as you get closer and closer to retirement is make sure you manage your risk with your own ability, because what do you not want to do? What you don't want to do is have your portfolio subject to large whims of the stock market. And even though the 90s, everybody thinks of a great decade where stocks went up 15% a year, I can remember several times, 1997, in one day, the Dow lost 8% during the Asian crisis. Fast forward one more year, 1998, long-term capital management went belly up. The Russians defaulted on their debt. The Dow was down 8% a day. Now, there was euphoria back then. So people said, and when the stock market went down, buy, buy, buy. Fast forward to 2010, 11, and 12, we thought the world was going to end every time there was a correction. Oh my God, I got to get out. You don't want to let emotions make your decisions when it comes to the investment market. And I can remember we had to fight this rather hard in 2012. If you were listening to the program, what were we telling you? Buy dividend-paying blue-chip stocks. What were people doing? They were buying gold, expecting the world was going to end. I love some of these commercials. Have you ever watched them on TV? My God, I think silver is going up to 200%. Alan, if I ever said that, they would probably arrest me. You don't want to let your emotions take over, and you want to make sure that who you are as an investor matches what you do as an investor. What you don't want to do, as we're seeing now, for the first time since this economic recovery and bull market, the individual investor is back in the market. And I'll show you where he's going in just a minute and why we think this is not a good place to be. And what happens at bottom, I actually had an individual, all kidding aside, came into our office March 8th, 2009. His portfolio was down about 15, 20%. We told him the Fed was going to initiate recovery. And he said, Jim, I have a heart condition. It's keeping me up at night. Sell. Sell everything. I said, keep something. These are quality stocks. He said, I can't handle it. Banks are going to collapse. The world's going to collapse. You remember what it was like in 2009? I used to hate Hank Paulson coming on the air. That was good for a 500-point drop every time he had a press conference. I mean, I think the Republicans would have won the re-election if they just got Hank off the air. But what we tend to do is we get euphoric at the top. At the bottom, we tend to panic. He literally sold one day before the bottom of the market. One day before the bottom of the market. Now let's talk about tax law changes. And this is going to shock you. I do not like them. I think it's coming at the wrong time. And we are seeing something we have never seen in the last 60, 70 years. And it's when, if you listen to my program, we hit upon it this weekend. Trump is the first president who enters office his first year in office with an aging business cycle in a Fed rate raising cycle. Think back Obama, recession, Fed cutting interest rates. Think back Bush, recession, Fed cutting interest rates. The only other president that has done that in my lifetime was his father, George H. Bush. He entered in an aging business cycle and a Fed rate raising cycle at the end of his presidency, and we saw what happened. There's another reason I oppose this. This is the first time we have monetary policy on one hand and fiscal policy on the other hand, fighting and working against each other. You normally get stimulus when you're in a recession to bring the economy out of the recession. Think back 2009, Obama's stimulus, $1 trillion of government spending. The Fed initiated QE1, $1.2 trillion of money printing, monetary policy supporting fiscal policy. Now you have monetary policy in direct conflict with fiscal policy. We've never seen fiscal stimulus coming at the end of a business cycle versus the beginning of the business cycle. And I predict if that tax cut goes through, you will see the Fed get more aggressive. And as the Fed gets more aggressive, what does that do? It's counteracting what we're seeing on the fiscal side. But let's take a look at this law. First of all, if you don't make much money, there's good news. Because the exemption is doubling from $12,000 to $24,000. The tax brackets are going to go from 7 or 8 to 3, although I heard they want to add two more. So the 15% bracket, 25, 28, 33 gets replaced with the 25. The 10 goes up to 12. They keep the 35 and they get rid of the 39.6. Here's what I don't like. They get rid of the deduction for medical. They get rid of the deduction for property and casualty losses. They get rid of miscellaneous deductions. They get rid of the deduction for state taxes. They get rid of the deduction for property taxes. Now think of what that means. Think of my client's mother who's in a retirement home spending $6,500 for long-term care. That's deductible. She doesn't pay taxes. That goes away. Think of all those individuals that live in Texas along the coastline, in Puerto Rico, or in Florida that lost their homes. If their losses exceed 10% of their adjusted gross income, they can write those losses off and carry them forward. That goes away. And for those of us that live here in California, where we have high taxes, the highest tax state in the country, you lose those deductions. And in my opinion, this is a Trojan horse. It happened, remember the 86 tax reform under Reagan? Tax rates went from 50 down to 28. We had 28 tax rate 1 year only. What went away was the excess deductions from real estate. What went away was sales tax. What went away was tax shelters. We had the 28% tax rate for 1 year. Following year, George H. Bush gets in, read my lips, raises tax rates to 31%. Following him, Bill Clinton comes in, raises tax rates to 39.6. So what happens is they get rid of the deductions for a small lowering of the tax rates. And so in my mind, this is a Trojan horse. It's coming at the wrong time. This would be better put in place when we're in our next recession, because the next thing it raises, what does the government do and what does the Fed do? If they go with stimulus now, what do they do when we're in a recession? What would the Fed do? So it's, in my opinion, it's economically coming at the wrong time. Now, the one thing I am in favor of is the change in the tax rates. And this is going to affect individuals, especially those that have S-corps. The way an S-corp works, you pay taxes as you take a salary out of your business. The excess profits of the business are passed through. The tax rate would drop from 39.6 on your personal tax return to 25%. The corporate tax rate would go from 35 to 20. Anybody have any idea what the average tax rate is of the G20 countries? 22%. 22%, and we're at 35. It's the reason why there's $2.5 trillion to $3 trillion parked in overseas profits. The other thing that they would do with this law is they would allow these companies to repatriate those profits back here, pay a one-time tax at 10%. But what they're going to do is make sure this doesn't happen again. So if you pay tax in Germany and you bring it home, or you leave it there, it doesn't matter. They're going to tax you on it. So that's going to change. So the government could get a windfall in the short term. The other thing, they would allow the expensing of capital gains, and they would remove. One of the things that they're going to do is place a limitation on interest expense, which is, I think, a good thing, because it prevents a lot of these companies from leverage up. Same thing in the banking system. Now, how this law is going to impact, it is going to impact those of you that live in California that make good income, because California has the highest tax rate in the country. Our current tax rate is 13.3%. So high tax states like New York, New Jersey are going to be impacted and could see their actual taxes. We were running a simulated tax case. What we don't know at this point is at what rate those tax rates kick in. And that's going to be key, because they're taking away all those itemized deductions. But if they push the brackets all up in which they kick in, then it'll be a true tax cut. I want to talk about another kind of risk that you don't hear too much about. You heard a lot about it in 2008. And that's the concentration of risk. What happened in the financial crisis is the big got bigger. But there's something else that's happening in this market that we have not seen before, is the dominance of index funds and algorithmic trading and the concentration of assets. Let me show you what I mean. In the financial crisis, you heard Dodd-Frank was going to prevent this from happening again. Unfortunately, that is not the case. We used to have five major investment banks. Today, we have two. We had Lehman Brothers go to Barclays, Washington Mutual went to J.P. Morgan, Bear Stearns went to J.P. Morgan, Merrill Lynch went to Bank of America, Countrywide went to Bank of America, and Wachovia went to Wells Fargo. So what you have today is six banks that control 90% of the nation's deposits. Really five. That's where all the deposits in this country are. And I guarantee you in the next downturn or next financial crisis, there's no way the government is going to let these banks fail. They will take them over like they did GM or Fannie or Freddie, recapitalize them and regulate them, and they'll end up being public utilities. Let's take a look at some of the risk. J.P. Morgan, $2.7 trillion in assets, big bank, $2.4 trillion in liabilities, net worth, equity of $264 billion, derivatives of $25.2 trillion. Citigroup, $1.9 in assets, $1.6 trillion in liabilities, $230 billion in equity, $45 trillion in derivatives. Goldman Sachs, net worth of $86 billion, derivatives of $32 billion, Bank of America, $23 trillion. 93% of all derivatives in this country are held in the hands of these four banks. On top of that, the $600 trillion around the world is in the hands of 10 banks, and they all do business with each other. Now, the problem is, there's good news here, is the amount of derivatives have been coming down as the Fed has forced many of these banks to de-risk to meet their risk tests. They peaked at $231 trillion. It's now down to about $179 trillion. But I think you would all admit $179 trillion is a big number. So it's coming down. Most of that is interest rate related derivatives. Now the banks would argue, because they make a lot of money on this, is that it really isn't that bad, because I have netted out my risk. Let's say I'm long the stock market. I've reduced my risk by going short the stock market with somebody else. Let me show you the why that doesn't hold up. Let's say I'm long 100 million in the stock market. I want to reduce my risk, so I am going to go short the stock market by 50 million. I might do that with puts. I may do it with some kind of derivative contracts. So my risk and exposure has gone from 100 million down to 50, because I've offloaded my risk to this guy, who's offloaded his risk to this guy, who's offloaded his risk to this guy, who's offloaded his risk once again to this guy. So when they're netting, they're all netting with each other. And that's what we saw when the government allowed Lehman to go under, a lesson I think they've learned. It institutes a domino effect, because your net risk position is only as good as the guy you bought your insurance from. AIG, biggest seller, $500 billion of credit default swaps. That's why the government had to bail them out by $200 billion. Holders of assets concentrated in five firms today. And I want to talk about something else that's distorting the market. And this is why when the market peaks, you won't know it. This is Amazon. Its market cap is $475 billion, sales of $160 billion, $2.8 billion in profits, selling at 252 times earnings. And by the way, Amazon is not that profitable of a company. Most of that profit, half of it, has come in the last 2 years. Compare that to Walmart, whose market cap is 236, who has sales of almost half a trillion, makes $12 billion in profits, selling at 19 times earnings, Costco at 68, 127. Another way of looking at it, Amazon is worth more than nine of its competitors, including Target, Macy's, Nordstrom's, Best Buy, and others. Let's take a look at where the bubble is forming. In 1975, there were $11 million in index funds. Today, it's $4 trillion. As you can see here, money flowing in, $500 billion last year. It's estimated $800 billion this year versus the money flowing out of active funds. How does this, what is gone? And one of the things that we still do at our firm, and we will always do at our firm, we actually analyze stocks. We actually analyze bonds. We buy individual stocks and bonds along with indexes. We do traditional analysis. The problem today, when you have computers doing the trading and people doing investing in index funds, where's the analysis? There is none. It's not taking place. It's being done by computers. One of the technicians I had on the program recently, we were talking about the VIX, which measures volatility, and it's very low. It's at a historical low. And one of the things he brought up that really struck me, computers, which do the trading, don't have emotions. They're not like you and I. They don't have fear. They don't have greed. There's just ones and zeros on a computer. It just does what the programmers tell that computer to do. So 90% of trading today is controlled by computers and index funds. Now let's talk about how this takes place in the market. And let's tell you how the market works. The S&P and the NASDAQ are what we call market weighted. The companies that are worth the most carry the highest percentage in the index. So, for example, Apple has a weighting of 2.85% in the S&P, 11.6% in the NASDAQ, and 4.7% in the Dow. Amazon, you can see here, Microsoft here. Now, what does this mean? I manage an index fund. I get $100 million in my S&P fund. What do I do? Out of that $100 million, I'm going to put $2.85 million into Apple. If I have a NASDAQ like the Qs, I'm going to put $11.6 million in the NASDAQ. So what happens is this is the weighting of the top 10 stocks in each index. And this is what catches investors by surprise and what we are watching. These 10 stocks carry the index. So towards the end of a bull market, you could see the stock market hitting new records on a daily basis. And you're thinking, this is good. The stock market's hitting new records. What's really happening is you have these stocks that are carrying the index. It's called the generals. The generals carry the index higher, while the troops fall by the wayside. So it distorts the market in many ways. For example, in the S&P, the top 10 stocks make up 16% of the index. The NASDAQ represents 51%. The Dow represents the top 10 or 55%. So you can see the difference that these stocks make up in the index. Even Jack Bogle, the founder of Vanguard, even said about today's trend to passive investing, these funds have led to the rise of merely the latest speculative hot potato passed around Wall Street. Let me give an example how that's done. And what Vogel was lamenting, they're no longer used for investing, they're used to speculate. We had 1.5 trillion in index ETFs in 2015 that turned over 864% in a single year, almost nine times their value compared to the top 100 stocks worth 12 trillion that only traded maybe once. So you're seeing these indexes used to speculate today. And you can see here the change as you get to the end of a bull market. Stocks represent now 53% of assets versus 44. Cash is 24 versus 32. And bonds have a smaller percentage. One of the reasons we believe rather strongly, given what we see, the cycle and what the Fed has done, what have you seen in every graph we've shown over the years when the Fed starts raising rates? What do you see on that graph? A downturn. A recession. And that's why I'm glad we don't make them in charge of the airlines, because I would quit flying. Because we know that every time they do that, they cause either recession or a bear market, and as we can see that. So how do you manage risk? You do it by minimizing the impact or exposure to recessions and bear markets. If you are nearing retirement 5 to 10 years or just retired, you avoid sequence risk, the devastating loss that can occur in a portfolio at the beginning of your retirement. And the nice thing about that is you don't have to get out at the top, and maybe you're not going to be smart enough to get in at the bottom. But if you can avoid the majority of this downturn, you can then have the cash enjoy the majority of this upturn. So we think by doing this, you have greater opportunities. Because who wouldn't like to have cash? Wouldn't you have loved to have been flush in cash in 2010 or 9 to buy real estate? buy real estate in Vegas, buy real estate in California, condos in Florida. So the thing for active planning, it just doesn't apply to your investments. It also applies, as you heard here on estate planning today, there's been many changes that have come about with laws where people really need to update their estate plans. A lot of people, they used to have what we call the typical AB trust, where you'd split them in two when one spouse passes away. You don't need those anymore if you were under $5.5 million. You could do something called the disclaimer trust that gives you the flexibility to split or not to split and less complicate your life. So as we summarize the key message today, we are in the late stage of a business cycle, in the mid stage of the Fed rate raising cycle. We are in an aging bull market with extreme valuations, which would imply, if you stay fully invested, lower future returns. We as a firm are in the process of de-risking to avoid sequence risk, and we highly recommend and practice active management.
Thank you for joining us for the 2017 Financial Sense Investment Strategy Conference. We also have a daily podcast at financialsense.com, where, of course, we hope to find you.